Well, brethren, the last day of a calendar year is often a time for looking backward in retrospect at the year and its events. It's also a time for looking forward in prospect at the coming year and its potential, its possibilities. For his discourse this morning, Brother Michael Brand has chosen a subject that asks us not to look backward nor to look forward, but to look upward. His title is one word, stargazing. Stargazing. Brother Michael.
Good morning, dear brethren. It's a pleasure for me to be here once again with you at Chicago. I was here, I think, 2 years ago, and it was a blessing then, and it's a blessing now. I want to bring love and greetings to you from many of the brethren at the BSRC, that's the Bible Students Retirement Center, especially my in-laws, David and Shirley Bruce, and you know, all the brethren wanted special greetings sent to you. And of course, the Schepelbaums being from this area. And if you heard the testimony yesterday, Brother Albert's name was brought up, and he could use an interest in your prayers too. And you remember all the friends. Think of Brother Albert and Sister Anastasia. He's struggling right now, so please remember them. When I mentioned the BSRC, you know, some at the BSRC actually think in terms of the Garden of Eden when they come to the Bible Students Retirement Center. One of our caregivers who lives outside, whenever she comes in, she talks about she feels like she's coming through our gates, coming into the Garden of Eden. And it is a beautiful place if you haven't been there. And in a sense, it is. Some of you have asked me what it's like to be there and, you know, to see some of the elderly. And we've had a couple of deaths in the past week. So we get to experience those things. And it is an experience to see that. And it's a difficult experience to watch. But at the same time, I feel truly honored to be there, because we feel like we spend all of our lives growing and developing fruit. And sometimes that fruit takes a long time to grow and to develop. And so I get to see the fruitage of these brethren who have spent their lives sacrificing in a variety of ways to serve the Lord, to honor Him. And I see them at their moments of death and leading up to it. Not that they're all in the condition of dying. There's a lot of younger people there too. Sister Lee and myself and the Austins and others. Young at heart. A lot of young at heart people too. And but it is an honor to see them at that stage of life when they're getting ready to pass beyond to the next stage to be with the Lord. There's still this hope and trust and confidence. I've never heard any one of them say, "I'm afraid of dying. I'm afraid of leaving. I'm afraid," or I'm not happy." It's full of confidence and joy and celebration, really. So it's a rare privilege to get to see this and to be amongst those residing at the Garden of Eden. And I would like to say, if any of you are ever thinking about making a move, don't wait too long, because sometimes if you get to a stage of 75 or 80 or 90 or 100, you can't really enjoy the true benefit and blessing that the BSRC offers. There's so much there. There's a lot of spiritual activities. There's two classes in the area. There's a lot of fellowship opportunities. We have guest speakers coming through. We have every once in a while some young people coming through that sparkle us and enliven us and enthuse us. And it's a great place to be. So if any of you are ever interested in knowing more about the BSRC, please come and talk to me. I'd be glad to talk to you about that. I want to share, in thinking of it, sometimes it's not the topic of a talk that I have a problem with. It's more like what to title it. And titles are so interesting to me. And I struggled with this one. What to term it, and maybe as we go through it, you'll probably figure out why I had trouble with it, because it's hard to pin it down. But staying at the Key Michaels, I've been a resident there last night, and I'll be there, I guess, tonight if they let me come back. But Azra let me stay in her room. It was nice. She sacrificed her room so I could stay there. And I, as I was looking through some of my notes last night, I happened to look at her ceiling. And on her ceiling, she has stars pasted all over the ceiling. And I appreciate that because I knew when I turn off those lights, those stars were going to come out. And stars have become meaningful to me over the past couple of years. Actually, even as a child, I remember as a boy, I used to go out around my corner where I used to live. It was a dark street, and there was a nice sloped curb. It was a very private place, and I used to lie on that cement coping and just look at the stars for what seemed like hours to me as a child. It was probably 10 or 15 minutes, but it seemed like a long time, and I was always enjoyed it because there always was something happening up there. And I didn't know God. I didn't know, I was a Catholic, but I didn't really know God personally. But I couldn't help but be impressed of what the message that was coming to me from the stars. And it was something beyond what my little life was all about, and something beyond there. It had a sense of wonder and inspiration and hope and expectation and the future. And this is part of life that we have. And coming to Chicago, I understand you don't get to see the stars too much. And if you have opportunity to go about 50 miles away from the nearest city where you can really look at the stars and enjoy them and get the message. And it reminds me of how David, as a shepherd boy, would look at those stars. And really, if you do that on even an infrequent basis, you really can't help but feeling like somehow wanting to express yourself like David did. It's so inspirational, as you know. I know you've done it before, but I hope you can able to continue this. This is kind of a personal testimony, too, in a lot of ways. It was about 1988, maybe 1989. Ginger and I went to Yellowstone National Park as a trip. And I think it was a year after a major fire swept through there. And, you know, there's fires all the time, and they allow them to burn. But this was a devastation to that park, and it left it in quite a state of charred remains. And it looked ugly. And blackened trees for miles, you could see. That's all you could see. And even if there were trees, some of them were just burnt all the way to the ground. And it was devastation. And as we were talking to the park rangers about it, and a couple of years later, I think we were there after the fire, but they were telling us that one of the things that happens as a result of any kind of fire like that, it burns off a lot of the surface soil, the topsoil, and it exposes things that have been buried under that top layer that were planted there, or for the seeds that have been planted there perhaps hundreds of years ago. So when you burn off that topsoil, it allows growth for trees and plants that they hadn't seen for hundreds of years there. They had documents previously recorded about what was growing, and it's changed. So when we came back from that, I thought that was a nice lesson. I could make a spiritual lesson out of that and think, as fires sweep through our various lives, as devastating as they are, it can then expose something that could grow that has been dormant in your life or my life. And I thought that was a great lesson. I remember in a discourse sharing that, and I didn't realize at the time that I was going to have to experience that myself and listen to my own words come back to me. And as the fire swept through my life in the loss of my beloved wife, I realized that I need to look for what now can grow out of that soil from that devastation. And I think in the past, well, maybe 6 months, I've seen now some emerging growth. And I'm trying to identify it, and I'm trying to work and understand and appreciate it and grow with it. And some of the new growth that I've experienced is the desire to look at the stars, We used to do that on occasion, but now I make it more of a habit. I try to go camping or try to go outside the city if I can and just look at the stars. Whether you have a telescope or binoculars or the naked eye, it really doesn't matter. Because you get the sense, I get the sense there's something beyond this life. God has a plan and a purpose. And I've been exploring a little bit in Genesis lately. And if our theory is correct about how we look at the Garden of Eden and what existed at the canopy of water that was supposedly over the earth up until the flood, if that was in existence, then that meant that Adam and Eve and all the antediluvian people up to Noah never, ever saw the stars. The sun was bright enough to penetrate, but they never even saw the sun in this, or the moon. But they could tell there was a great light. Just on a cloudy day, sometimes you can figure out where the sun is in the sky because it's so magnificent and so brilliant. But the stars would never have penetrated that. And I think about the psychological impact that would have been not to be able to be like David or us, to go out and look at those stars and say, wow, how great you are, God, just because of what's there. And so being deprived of that, it just makes me think. But in the book of Genesis, which is recorded, I think, by Adam and passed down to where Moses transcribed this, he tells us that God created the sun and the moon and the stars, but Adam had never seen them. So he was really acting by faith that they were there. Only later on in history, and imagine Noah emerging with his family from that ark, and that first night, looking up and seeing what they've never seen before, the stars, and what that would have brought to their mind. And this is what I feel like for me, in my growth potential, and what's there, and what I see growing, is a deeper understanding of God and a deeper desire to know what His plan is for me. And one of the things that I'm going to share with you, I probably have shared this with some of you, at the time of Ginger's death, or just right before it, it was about 2 weeks before she died, and I was really trying to understand what this was going to mean to me, and I was trying to prepare myself. And as hard as I could, when it happened, I realized I was totally unprepared. But I remember going to this park one day and sitting out looking over the water. There was a beautiful waterfront we used to go to. And this day I came home from work early to be with her, and I decided I'm going to go to this park and stop and try to absorb this. And I was shaken to my deepest core level. And trying to understand it. And as I was thinking about it, I thought, this is so devastating to me. Is there a God? God, are you really there? How can you let this happen to me, to us? How can you take my Eve away from me after you've given her to me? And I thought about, is the Bible really the Word of God? Is there really going to be a resurrection? Am I really going to see Ginger again? Are the world, are they all going to come back? So these thoughts rolled through my mind. And I was happy to say that I came away from that day probably stronger than going into it. I thought much about what the experience with the apostles, when Jesus was teaching them and they were finding people rejecting them and casting them away, where they thought everyone was going to welcome their message and welcome Jesus, and it wasn't happening as they expected. And Jesus asked them if they are going to turn away too. And you remember Peter's wonderful response. You know, Lord, where would we go? You have the words of eternal life. And that's what my thought too. Where would I go? Where could I turn to for hope, for inspiration? I've been in the world. I was born in the world. I grew up in the world. And I studied worldly philosophers enough to know that they did not know which end was up. They had a lot of good speculation, a lot of good ideas, but there was no authority behind what they said. I could have made up my own philosophy, and it would have been just as valid as Thoreau or Emerson or Plato or Aristotle or any of those guys. But knowing God, His Word, this was His Word. So I realized I can rest on His Word. So I came away, whatever was going to happen, I felt like God would give me the strength to endure it. And it took a while to really go through it and to emerge from it, and I feel like I am. But one of the things I concluded from that day is that I'm not going to accept anything that's presented to me as truth without me validating it personally. Because I didn't want to go through this experience again of having my whole mental psyche rocked to its core and question. I didn't want that to happen again. So now I'm very careful if anyone presents something, an idea that this is the truth, I've made it my own personal decision. I'm going to verify this for myself by the comparison of Scripture before I adopt this as my own. So very carefully I'm relaying everything that I have the solid foundation, but I'm relaying everything on that. And if someone says, here's a brick that should be put in the wall as you're building, I'm looking at that brick. And I'm saying, I don't know if I'm going to use this one right now. I'll put it on the side. But if I find use for it, or if I find that it's true, I'll put it on there and I'll build this house again. So this is where I'm at in life, and this is part of my testimony. And so, one of the things I'm doing right now, I happen to be involved in the study of the book of Isaiah. And I want to share with you a couple of things on Isaiah that are meaningful to me. I just want to make sure I'm not missing something I intended to say. Okay, Isaiah is a very interesting character in the Bible. To me, he's always been just, in my mental vision of Isaiah, he's an old guy with a beard, gray hair, probably 60 years old, and he was born 60 years old and he died 60 years old. He never grew up like you and I did. He was just born that way, and he was a prophet and everyone listened to him. But that's not the case. He was a young boy at one time. He grew up and he died, just like you and I will. And he grew as a person. He grew as a prophet of the Lord, too. Just as our Lord, even himself, grew in wisdom and in stature. Isaiah was the same thing. The first chapter of Isaiah, we'll get into this a little bit. Isaiah, and oftentimes many of the books, are not written in a chronological order. And you'll find this, like Hosea is another example. But Isaiah had a ministry of about anywhere from 45 to 60 years was the length of his ministry to the nation of Israel, or actually to the two-tribe kingdom. Judah, Jerusalem was his home base. And so the first chapter was really a synopsis of his whole life. It's kind of like writing a history of yourself, and then at the end of your life you say, well, before I publish the chronology of what I'm about to say, I'm going to give you kind of an overall synopsis of my whole life's ministry and my mission or my vision. And he does this really in the first chapter. And we're going to probably, even if we continue to get further enough, we'll look into another section, which is chapters 2 through 6. It's another kind of interesting aspect of Isaiah. But Isaiah, the first chapter, I guess I should read a couple of verses, and just to get you in the flow of the context of what Isaiah's message is. But it's about, the first verse says, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, and verse 2 says, hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. So the imagery he's drawing here is for the heavens and the earth to hear. And Isaiah is a prophet who uses a lot of natural phenomenon. He uses trees and sky and stars to develop his theme. And, of course, this isn't literal. He's not looking for literal heavens to look at it. But in a sense, he's calling forth for heavens and earth to be a judge and jury of what he's about to convict the nation of Israel about, and especially the two-tribe kingdom. And it goes on, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken, I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. And this is what we see page after page in the Old Testament. Israel's fluctuation. First they're servants and then they disobey. Obedient, disobey. It's continued. But overall, God is not pleased with the nation. And verse 4, a sinful nation, O people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers. This is His chosen people He's speaking of here. And it continues on in this fashion. And He's trying to really draw this like in a courtroom. You've all seen television programs. You've probably been to a courtroom, had some kind of experience with it, or you've got a judge who sits up there and he's listening to all the pleadings from both defendant and the offendant and listening to it. And here, there's no one really to defend them because their position is indefensible and they're convicted. And all the story is, their history is recounted here in a very short passage in all this, but it's really covering 60 years or more of the ministry of Isaiah. And in this courtroom drama, you have the heavens and the earth witnessing this. And God is the judge and the jury. And He pronounces a sentence upon them. And the sentence is really coming down to verse 18. And this is something that's a very interesting passage. You probably know this one by heart. And it's too bad. Isaiah, we really pick things out of Isaiah, like Isaiah 53, it's a favorite one. But to really kind of grasp an overall concept of Isaiah, he's probably the most abused prophet, I think, in the Bible. Because of the way we just pick and choose from things of his, not we, I mean as Christians as a whole, not Bible students. But Christians as a whole are all familiar with, say, Isaiah 53. But they're not familiar with his whole life and his whole ministry, which is too bad because he was an amazing, amazing prophet. Probably one of the most beloved in the nation of Israel as far as prophets go. Verse 18 says in the King James Version, come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord. And this is kind of a remarkable sentence when you really think about it. And there's two ways to look at this. One is, there are some translations that suggest, instead of let us reason together, it's let's draw the matter to a conclusion. This is the courtroom scene, and now the judge is going to say, he's going to pass the verdict on the nation. And his verdict is, and it will go on to address that. That's one way to look at this, and I think it's appropriate. Another way is that Isaiah is asking the nation, and God is asking him, to come and let us reason together. This is something that is very unique to the nation of Israel, to ask them to reason with God. Although they should have known that because Abraham is someone who did that when God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And remember Abraham, he tried to reason with God. Are you sure? Can we just drop those numbers? What if I can find 40 or 30 or 10? I forget what he did. It got to like 5 people. And he was reasoning with God. And the nation should have known this, but they had forgotten this concept that God is not unreasonable. He's inviting them and us to reason with Him. God should not be someone that He just dictates to us and we're like robots and do what He says. I'm sure that's a good thing to do. But He doesn't want you to do it that way. He's inviting us as a nation and the nation to reason with Him. He's not unreasonable. And this is unique. Because Isaiah, if you look in other passages of Scripture and other prophets, they talk about how high and lofty God is. He's far past. You can't understand God. He's way up there and you're down here on this little earth. Who are you to reason with such the Almighty? But here Isaiah asked them just to do just that. So you got God, the high and the lofty one, the God of the infinite, and then you got the God of the practical. And God is both of those. And I think that's a great lesson for us. We should worship God. He's deserving of our highest forms of worship and praise. But He's also a God who He's interested in the smallest details of your life. He wants you to come and talk to Him about them. And we'll see this in the next couple of chapters, if we ever get there. because he talked about very specific things, about even what the women were wearing, their jewelry and bracelets. I mean, that's very minute stuff. And this is kind of his invitation. When you have a problem in life, whether it be school or church or society, work, home, personal, health, talk to God about it. This is all he wants you to do. The last part of this verse, verse 18, shows a God who is an amazing God. He's convicted them of all their crimes and punishment, or all their sins, and they're turning their back from a God who is always wanting to be there for them, and they continue to rebel. And this is his verdict on the matter, is not that you've earned punishment and I'm going to punish you for the rest of eternity, but his verdict is, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. That's his verdict. And that should have, and so Isaiah introducing this to the nation was kind of an interesting phenomenon. And this is, again, looking back from a historical standpoint from his day. This is writing from the end of his life. He's recording this. So I think there's a good lesson. The high and the lofty, he wants to be close by to us. And their reason, or the final analysis, is being brought to the conclusion that their sins would be erased. And he didn't say exactly how it was going to happen. He just said it was going to happen. And we've seen, as we understand, the God's message and plan for Israel, they will be purged from their sins, but it's going to take a process. It will take a purging process, just like ours. I'd like to think of a lesson for you and I in all this. And that is to look at some of these people and books of the Bible not as unrelated to us, but totally related to us. I love thinking about God as the high and lofty. When I look at the stars, that's what helps me understand that God is high and lofty and worthy of the highest form of praise that I can elicit. But he's also the God who wants to walk with me every step of the way and hold my hand and direct me if I let him. And that's the same that he's willing to do for you. I'd like to try to figure my segue into this next section. And I guess it's in the form of Bible study in my own life. I'm finding how important it is to study the Scriptures on my own with all the helps that are available and try to really understand. So I'm of the part of mine now to dig as deep as I can. And I know there's so much substrata and level that I can't really dig as far as I'd like to because it would take too much time. But I think it's important to dig as deep as you can, as much as opportunity and circumstances afford you. And because of my circumstances, I have a little bit more time than I used to a few years ago. And as I think about this, I think about, in Revelation, I think about this quite often, is when the Lord pronounced things about the seven churches and what they were like. And he mentioned some of their strengths and weaknesses. And I think that if I were an outsider, which I am, looking at the Chicago class, and what would I say about the Chicago class? And this is why I have the board up here, and I'm going to try to write some of this on here, if I can maneuver here, which is also a good way to move away from this platform. I appreciate Brother Rick Sarasi. I don't know if he's here. I like it when he moves around. I don't like being tied to this. So this gives me a way to get away from here without being too dramatic about it. But if I were to think about the Church of Chicago and the reputation that it has, or the name, you know, that's what a name really means. It means who you are, what you are. And each of you have a name. And if I know your name and I know you, I connect the two. And Chicago has a name, just like the Church of Ephesus and Smyrna and Philadelphia. They all had names because they had characteristics associated with them. And I think I'm going to leave the part for what the Lord has against you in Chicago. The next speaker will talk about that. Okay, but these are some things that I've just been thinking about. And one is, and as I'm sure all of you can't see or read this, but it's the history of the Chicago Ecclesia. You've got a rich history. Some of you, I heard some about it yesterday. Brother Albert going with the brother to the CO thing. And I hear David and Shirley Bruce, especially Shirley, tells me about the early history of the Chicago class when, in the days of Rutherford, when the strong-arm tactics were tried to be applied in Chicago, someone stood up and said, "We're going to meet down at so-and-so street next week. Anyone wants to come, show up." And that's the story I got. And in fact, it was Shirley's father, Irving Foss. That's the way I got it from her. And I should have asked Joy if that was the case. But I think that's the way it happened. So you've got this kind of a history of standing for the truth. And that history still is today. Those genetics from the history of the Chicago class are passed along to those who are part of the Chicago class today. And I'm thinking of not just those who are this ecclesia, but even probably the satellite ecclesias and even the Polish ecclesia. I'm not too sure if there still is a Polish class. I understand now. They do meet at the press on Saturdays. But even the Polish ecclesia has gained some of the heritage that has been passed on to them. So the Chicago class has a rich heritage. Another thing that I always think about is how large it is. And I don't know if it's the largest class in the... I think it's the largest class in the country. And it might be the... I don't know. I've never been to Poland. I understand there's some large classes there. But it's always been renowned for its capacity, and which is a good thing because most of the classes are very small. But Chicago has always maintained a fair number of brethren. Another thing that they're really known for is I'm going to put publishing, but I would say that's similar to witnessing because that's the idea of publishing. It's not only to promote the welfare and instruction of the brethren, but it's also to enlighten the world, anyone who will listen and understand. So you've got a lot of publishing work going on here, which is a very good evaluation, I would think, in the Lord's estimation. He's happy to see those interested in proclaiming His Word. Okay. Okay. I was thinking kind of maybe a spinoff from this are, I'm just going to put activities, and that's specific activities that individuals do. There's a lot of individuals, and if I start naming names, I'm really going to get in trouble. But there's a lot of brethren here who are individually active in harvest work, in publication, in teaching. You know, especially when you look maybe under the history of elders, you have some here, even non-elders, who will have lived their whole life devoted to serving the brethren of Chicago. They don't go anywhere. They don't move. They don't travel to other foreign countries and live there for long. They've stayed right here because that, they feel, is their ministry. And they've sacrificed their whole life for the sake of promoting the truth among the brethren. That is a blessed experience to have. Loving, shepherding elders who watch out for the interest of the flock. A marvelous thing. And I'm sure none of us really think about that often enough, that we have people who are dedicated to do that. So it's a marvelous blessing from the Lord. One that I think He would say, as He's looking down and says, Chicago class, yes. And there's other classes, of course, who do the same thing. These are principles that God would appreciate wherever they're found. Okay, I would say, I'm going to put a label to, as a conservative type fellowship here, and, you know, kind of in the middle of Bible student theologies, I guess, if you will. They're probably more on the conservative side of the spectrum, which is much appreciated. And it's good to have the liberal, it's good to have the conservative. And we get a nice mix of trying to understand for ourselves. If we just had one viewpoint all the time, you better make sure that viewpoint is totally accurate. But when you get an opportunity to share divergence of opinion, it's quite a privilege. And then that puts it where it should be on you as an individual to say, yeah, this is the way I see it. And this is the way I appreciate it because I'm studying it for myself, which is what I'm getting back to me on all this. I think it's something that the Lord promotes in all of us is to study, to make sure and steadfast those things that are really the truth. Okay. I almost overlooked this one. And I was thinking about it last night because I had a great opportunity with some of the youth here. To train up the youth in the way that they should go is another blessing of the Lord. And the Chicago class has made a habit of doing this from its inception. They train their young people. And if you meet some of the young people from the Chicago area, you'll know that they've been trained. We've had the blessed privilege at the BSRC to have had three representatives from Chicago come out this past summer and serve there. And they brought the name of Chicago with them. And I'll tell you, they did the Chicago class proud. And it was a reflection on the leadership that they've gotten here, leadership on the ones and twos that you meet with day in and day out that made them who they are. They are who they are because they've learned this from you, from the leadership, from the Chicago class. And their characters were sterling. And I can go back and everyone back at the BSRC knows every one of their names. They remember everything about them. They remember the lunches that they sat with them. They remember the work they did, their friendship, their cordiality, their spirituality. And I'm not going to go on. I'll cry here in a minute. Okay. And there was one from Orlando that was there too. He wasn't too bad either. So, good reflection on the Orlando class. Something else, and this probably falls under the publishing work somewhere, and that is what I'm going to put down as a particular feature that I've appreciated, and this is the publication of the Herald magazine. And I just want to point out, I don't know, it was a special issue what I think it was about when they did kind of the history of the truth movement, and they reflected not only Brother Russell, but went back even prior to him. And I can't remember all the names, Henry Grew and Dunn and George Storrs and people of that ilk and era. And I appreciate that a lot. One of the things kind of in combination with that, well, there was another article I liked too, especially. And that was something, and I'd like to see them continue, and that was a brief review, kind of like a linguistic, Hebrew language, about root words. And it was such a simple but beautiful article, and it really helped me as I go back now and study some Hebrew and Greek terms, I look at the Hebrew letters, and yeah, I can see that now this root word. Without that little article in the Herald, I would have really probably never known that. And it never hurts to understand the original language in which we're studying. And I've always been very opposed to learning languages. I've got a terrible mental block, but that's something I think I can overcome with those little things, little articles that were, to me, intriguing. But I want to go back to this thing about the Herald article on, especially the article on the early foregleams of, say, the harvest worker movement. And one of the things that also I think comes out of Chicago is the Harvest Truth Database associated with the online Bible program. To me, this is a gift of God. To have this program at our fingertips, and as more and more computers are becoming part of society, it's like cell phones. I mean, they're everywhere. Everyone has them. And everyone now has access to something that if people down through history have had this, I don't know what they would have done. They probably would never leave their house. They'd probably be studying all the time and gleaning information. And this perhaps might be a little bit of controversy because I know everyone doesn't like the idea that there's commentaries on there that aren't from Brother Russell. And there are people go back to like this article, Grew and Dunn and Stores. There's all kinds of information on there, but it even precedes them. It goes back to people I've never even heard of until I got the online Bible and started downloading some of these commentaries. Some I'd heard of, but some were new. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, I always used to jokingly call them the lawyers. And we had the lawyers' library at our home, and we'd say, well, pull out the lawyers, see what they say on this. And we had, you know, Keel and DeLeets and McLaren and Gill, and I don't know if Jeff Mezra's in the audience, he could probably tell you some of these other names. But these people, they were just not your average person who, your average Christian you find out on the street maybe who, you know, praise the Lord, hallelujah. These people were people who dedicated their lives in the service to God. It was their priority in life to study the Scriptures, to learn them, to go deep into them, to look at. Many of them knew Hebrew and Greek languages. They went to school, and that's what they were learning to do. And these were amazing characters, and most of them were men. But, you know, there was always a good woman, I'll bet, behind every one of those men, promoting what they were doing and encouraging them to keep on this track. And we now have the benefit of that fruitage. These people who have dedicated their lives to praising God, to if you read some of these commentaries on a variety of things, and it's spectacular, the phraseology. And I just want to get down on my knees and praise God for the way they're able to express an idea that I could have never thought of. And I've never seen, read, or heard speak of before. And it's very beautiful. Now, the flip side of that coin is, too, sure, there's error there. Most of these people were what we would call Trinitarians and believed in hellfire. But to me, those are so easy to pick out. When they start talking about the incarnation or the incarnate God and Trinity and hellfire, I mean, it's easy, so easy to dismiss this, that part. But to kind of neglect all the other body of work that they've done that to me brings so much glory and honor to God, to dismiss that easily is, I'm not going to say it's a sin, but it's not expedient, I would say, for Christian growth because there's so much there. And you can take it or leave it. I'm not going to, as Rick said yesterday, this is my opinion on the matter. But as my father-in-law says, it's a very good opinion. I'm trying to make sure I know what time I'm supposed to leave it. Is it 11 o'clock? Chairman, okay. Okay, good. Okay, let's return back to Isaiah, the first chapter, if we could, for a minute. And I'm imagining if you've ever probably, I don't know, maybe some of you have been on the receiving end of a trial, a verdict that went against you. And I have. I mean, I've been in court where I've been convicted of speeding or something like that. Nothing too serious. I was never thrown in jail or committed any kind of crime like that. But just being told that you're paying a fine, and I remember getting all nervous about it. I thought, boy, I wish I could have done that over again. I wouldn't have done that, what I did. And I'm thinking, Israel, sitting here in this courtroom and thinking the whole world, heaven and earth, are in this courtroom as judge, jury, trial. They're listening to all this, and they're the center of all this focus of attention. And to a man, there's not one that says, let's let them go. You know, they're not guilty. No, they are guilty. But I keep thinking, boy, if they had to do it all over again, I would think they would probably do it different. But I don't know. Maybe they would do the same thing. And I keep thinking about back to the Garden of Eden. If Adam and Eve had to do it all over again, would Eve have done what she did? Would Adam have taken what Eve offered? And I'll bet they rehearsed that scenario in their own life. They had, what, Adam, 930 years that he lived. So they had a lot of time to review what happened. And how many times they probably said, of course, at first they blamed each other. You know, when God talked to Adam, he said, well, it's the woman that gave me to eat and I took it. And, you know, it's not my fault, it's her fault. And you gave her to me and here, look what she did. And of course, you know, she blamed Adam too. So they probably did that for a while in their life, but they could have never stayed together as a married couple if they continued blaming. I'm sure they finally got to the point and said, you know, it's obvious that God must have intended it this way or of some fashion, and I forgive you, and you forgive me, and let's make the best we can of life. And I think this is what God did them too. He could have punished them severely and made life totally miserable for them, but he didn't do that. He went out of his way to keep them accommodated in life. I mean, of course they were expelled from the garden, but when they went out, I mean, it wasn't like a place where they could not live in. They could make their way, and they did well for the 900 and some years that they were still on the earth. They did pretty darn good, and they're amazing people. I can't wait to meet Adam and Eve. And I mentioned this last night, and I think that Adam and Eve are probably two of the greatest patriarchs that have ever lived. After all, they gave us the legacy as they passed it down from generation to generation. They saw the importance of all this. They saw the importance of the tree, of the knowledge of permission of evil, the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, and the partaking of it, and their heaven, their home that they lost. They appreciate all these things, and they didn't make up a story and say that something was untrue. They told the truth. And that truth is passed on to us today, and that's why I think they're some of the greatest people that's ever lived, because they were totally honest, and they dealt with the problem. It's, you know, I had the opportunity to call back to the BSRC yesterday, and there was a situation that happened, and it involved the fire department. And I'm not going to go into the details of that. But the fire department couldn't come out quickly because they said there's been 88 suicides in this area just in the past couple of days. And I thought, 88 suicides in the past couple of, I mean, is there a mass suicide going on or something? Like, what was it, that James, somebody, I don't know, I forget the country, but there's like a whole bunch of people committed suicide. And they said, no, this is normal. This is normal this time of year, 88 suicides in our little Portland area. And, you know, because this, you know, I know I'm not going to go into reasons why. But I keep thinking about Adam and Eve. That could have been a choice they could have made. Look what we've done. We've plunged ourselves. We've lost our home, our relationship with God. It's been damaged. And we're going to pass this on to our kids for the rest of their lives. And who knows how long this is going to go on. I would imagine suicide may have crossed their mind. But they didn't. They lived through it. And that, to me, is a sign of God's favor upon them and to their character. But if they could have done it again, I wonder if they would have done that. And I think in my own life, and your own life too, if you had a chance to do some things over again, would you have done them, knowing the consequences? And I'm sure you probably would have said, no, I would have done something different. And I know I certainly would have. And I want to give you a couple examples. And this is relation to Ginger and my relationship with her. And I was asked a question not too long ago, just on that point. If you had, what was something you said or did with your spouse that you enjoyed and you thought you remembered, and it was something very special? And then vice versa. What's something you wish you would have done but you didn't do? Or wish you had said now that you could have done it again? And I'm going to say one good thing and one bad thing. When I was a young elder in Seattle, and I think this was the first year I was an elder in Seattle, and I was the chairman of the convention, and that was a big deal for me. I was quite nervous about it. I'd never done it before. And a lot of commotion going on, and there's a lot of things to think about. And I remember being up on the platform, and just like everywhere, they're singing and people talking and trying to get everyone seated for the time. And it looked like total chaos. And I was quite overwhelmed. And I looked over and I remember being up on the platform and just like everywhere, they're singing and people talking and trying to get everyone seated for the time. And it was looked like total chaos. And I was quite overwhelmed. And I looked over to the piano player, which was Ginger. And she was there at her station, ready to play, looking at me and just waiting for the direction. And that gave me such a sense of calmness. And knowing that she was there in support of me and support of the convention. And I remember talking to her afterwards. And I said, I was very nervous and it was a difficult time. But when I saw you and your preparedness, that relaxed me so much. And I remember, and she cried. She cried at those, just those simple words. And I just said, I really appreciate your devotedness and your care for me and for the convention. And I remember the tears streaming down her face. And I was kind of, well, why are you crying? And it's because sometimes we don't take the time to say some of the smallest things because we don't probably think about it. But so I'm encouraging you to just think about some of these little things that people do for you, whether it be your husband, your wife, your spouse, your brother, your sister, your elder, your deacons, your fellow churchmates. What's some little thing they do for you? Surprisingly, say something about them, and I'm sure they're going to remember that the rest of their life. I do. I remember that. And I know if Ginger were here, she would remember that experience too. That was a good thing I did. One of the bad things I did, well, I wish I could have done again, was we were going to the International Convention. This was in Poitiers, France. And that's a trip of a lifetime just to go overseas to visit some of these countries. But France, we were in Paris, France. You know, this is some people's dream of a lifetime is to go visit Paris, France, the city of romance and history and art and classics and a beautiful, beautiful city. We were sitting in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower, and we loved the Eiffel Tower. It was a magnetic presence for us. And we'd go there. We had a couple days visit before the convention started. So we spent the time in Paris, and we kept coming back to the Eiffel Tower and its surroundings. So we had lunch at one of these little outdoor cafes. Oh, the kind you see in postcards. And right there on the sidewalk, the Eiffel Tower down the road, and just a gorgeous day, spectacular weather, and we were in good health and, you know, anticipating the convention. And it was one of those days we'll never forget. But I wish I would have said something like, you know, Ginger, this is a day we'll probably remember for the rest of our lives. And it's beautiful here. We're far away from home, this city of intrigue and romance and beauty. And I want to take this occasion to say, while we're here, that this would not be the same. It wouldn't mean anything to me without you being here with me. That you're what makes Paris, Paris to me. You're what makes going to convention worthwhile. You're what brings joy to my life. You're my Eve. You're my helpmate. Not in the sense of you're my maid, you cook my meals and do my laundry and all these kind of things. You're the helpmate to me. And I want to take this time to say how much I love you and how glad I am that the Lord brought us together. Now, I guarantee that that day would have lived in infamy with her for the rest of her life. And me too. And we would look back on that day for the next 50 years and said, remember that day? And yes, I do. I certainly do. But I didn't do that, and I regret that. So my thought is that you, when you're sitting in your Parises, wherever they might be, and with your spouse or your friends or loved ones, take the time and tell them that you love them and appreciate them and enjoy their company. Because it's without someone to enjoy the beauty of life with, it's almost not worth it. And I think back at the creation of Adam, going around the garden, this beautiful paradise, the trees and the fruit and so much beauty. I don't know if we can really conceive how beautiful that place was. And the animals, and although he couldn't see the stars, but he knew that there was life and it's springing water, verdure, beauty. He realized there was something missing from his life. And I don't know if he really pinpointed it, if he said, you know, God, you need to give me a wife. Am I causing this? Okay, sorry. For sure it's me. Who else? I blame someone else. Yeah. I think it's you. But where was I? Oh, thinking about where he was in the garden and coming to the conclusion that he was alone. And that God gave him not the request of his mouth, but did something far spectacular. That was giving him something from his heart, something from his soul that God could read, say, you know, Adam, I realize you've come to a right conclusion in this. You do need someone, and here she is. And I imagine those first moments together, when he woke up from his sleep, finding his beloved Eve there, looking at her and thinking, well, she's not like the lions and the tigers and the bears and the reptiles. I mean, she's really different. And I like it. And I want her to like me. And I just imagine how they explored one another and talked. And I don't think that God gave them baby talk. Ooh, dude, ooh, boo. I mean, I don't know how they talk. But they talked. God gave them a language that they could communicate with God and with one another. They talked. And Adam probably says, let me show you my home. Let me show you your home. And let's go share this together. And that relationship always is just inspiring to think about, that God gave them this and prepared for this. Well, I didn't know which direction I was going to go through from here, and because it's almost time to close, I think I'll go in the direction of closing. But maybe laying something for an outline for tomorrow, perhaps, if we continue along this line. And that is the action of God's casting them out of the garden. No, I'm not going to go there. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe I want to stress this point. Brother Ernie yesterday said something I really enjoyed in this divine love aspect, and that is to take initiative. You know, it's really easy to sit in a seat or wherever you're at and wait for someone to come and tell you how much they love you. But it takes initiative. It takes faith to walk out and to tell someone else this. And I just want to encourage that, to take an opportunity to share those things with people. And you'll be, I'm sure you probably do it. Maybe you practice this and maybe I'm talking to the wrong group. But I don't think so. I think that it's a common trait is to take people for granted, take one another for granted, to take God for granted. And when I think of the creation, Adam and Eve, as they got to know one another and thought, you know, you're the perfect mate for me and I'm the perfect mate for you, they couldn't help going back to God and all this and saying, you know, how wise, how loving, how kind, how powerful, how majestic God you are. So when we get to these things about loving and expressing our love toward one another, make sure we don't leave God out of the picture, because without Him, none of us, none of these things would even exist. So it demands, it calls, it requests some elicitation of praise and honor due to our Lord. Well, I think I'm going to close there and just stress again this reasoning aspect. And but the stargazing, I'll wrap it up with that. As I was going to bed last night and saw those stars on Azra's ceiling and going to sleep, and I looked at those stars for quite a while. And although they're plastic and these day glow things or night glow things, they were remarkable. And it's remarkable to me that a young child wants this on their ceiling, because it almost tells me that this person has already, as a child, a concept that something beyond the scope of their own life, that something out there beyond their own existence, that it brings hope and expectation and longing and desire. And so glad that one day God is going to fulfill those desires, those longings in every heart and mind. And He'll not leave anything undone. Everyone will be completely, contentedly satisfied to their deepest core level. So don't forget to look at stars because they bring hope, they bring courage, they brought hope to my life. And that's one of the things I used to like about Ginger and I used to look at the stars. And when I do that, it reminds me, every time I look at the stars, it reminds me of our relationship. And I do this quite often. Because it gives me this sense of connectivity. I don't know if she's out there. I don't know if she sees me sitting by the campfire dreaming about someday seeing her and being with her again. I don't really know if she has the power to do that. I don't know what God has limited His called ones, His select ones, to do at this point. I like to think that she can see and hear, but I don't really know. But I'm looking forward to that day when God's going to satisfy the longings in my soul, just as He did Adam's longings. And He'll not leave me disappointed, and He'll not leave any of you disappointed. So with that, I'll turn the platform back to the chairman. Oh, he's here. How long have you been here? Oh. Sorry.